Good morning. How is everybody this morning? How are all the children of God? You believe that? Really believe that? That you're a child of God? So what does that mean for the rest of the day? It's an important question. There are all kinds of important questions like that. This morning, Jesus is going to ask an important question of one of his close friends. We're going to reflect back on what we looked at last week and try to figure out the answer that this close friend of Jesus actually found as his life went on. But we've been working our way through a series on shepherding, on the 23rd Psalm. The series is entitled, Because the Lord is My Shepherd. And this particular study this morning is part 4. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I comfort the sheep. I want to remind you again, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but eventually I will. You really need to get started on this Psalm 23 thing. I know it's only 6 verses and 6 very familiar verses, but we're asking everybody to memorize Psalm 23 between now and when we finish this series, which will be December 6. In the long run, you can give yourself the gift of Psalm 23. You could pull it into your Christmas tradition this year, where you just take the opportunity to quote it to one another and remind one another of what it means to be shepherded by God, to be one of the sheep of his pasture, as Psalm 100 put it. What we're trying to do is try to understand what each of these phrases in Psalm 23 means for us in our lives today, in terms of how God interacts with us in the midst of our mess, in the midst of our joys, in the midst of our sorrows, in the midst of the hiccups of life, how he interacts with us. And from that, we're going to try to take some cues. God shepherds me, and I've learned to experience, learned to expect a certain quality of life because the Lord is my shepherd. David describes that quality of life in Psalm 23. If I expect a certain quality of life as I'm shepherded by my shepherd, what can we say then about the people who are under our care, the sheep for whom we care in the course of a week, our children, our spouse, all of the people in our lives that look to us for guidance, look to us for leadership, ask us to make decisions on their behalf and interact with them when they're in pain, as they make their journey, especially if they're children, as they make their journey to becoming shepherds themselves, as they get married and grow, and now there will be sheep under their care, who, by the way, will be your grandchildren, because that's how it works. I talked to a lot of people who said if I knew how much fun having grandchildren would be, I would have just skipped right over having children and gone straight to that. And it just doesn't work like that. You make the investment in time in your children, and by God's grace, that pays off in the lives of your grandchildren as you continue to interact with them. So all that to say, memorizing Psalm 23 would be a really good thing to do so that you can raise your hand, if nothing else. So far in this series, we've looked at 3 principles of shepherding. Psalm 23:1 says, because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything that I need. And from that, we drew the first principle, principle number 1. If I'm a shepherd, it's because I'm aware of the needs of the sheep and seek to meet them. That's what God does for us. That's what God does for me. And so in turn, that's what I want to be able to pass along. Psalm 23:2-3 says, he makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. And from that, we drew principle number 2. If I'm a shepherd, it is because I ease the burden of the sheep. And the last of them we looked at last week, the last of the 3rd verse in Psalm 23 says, he leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And from that, we drew principle number 3. If I'm a shepherd, it is because I keep the sheep on course for the glory of God. We agreed last week, or at least I think we agreed, that a shepherd lives for the glory of God. That is the sole motivator in a shepherd's heart. And everything that the shepherd does for the sheep is ultimately so that they can get on course and stay on course in their daily lives so that God can receive the glory. And when the sheep are successful at that, staying on course, the shepherd remembers that a shepherd lives for the glory of God. In other words, if God uses a shepherd to do something amazing, and we talked about this in Sunday school, I think Chad's going to be surprised at how what he said this morning relates to what we're about to say as well. But in other words, if God uses a shepherd to do something absolutely amazing, and one or even more of the sheep come along afterward and praise the shepherd is careful to return that praise to the one who truly deserves it. That's just part of being a shepherd. And the shepherd does that by bundling up that praise. At least that's the method that I use if I receive praise during the course of a day. I hold on to it for a little bit. I don't know if that's to my discredit, but I hold on to it for a little bit, and then I bundle it up, and I take it into the presence of my shepherd, and I say, this belongs to you. Because I know that everything that's true about me, everything that's good about me, everything that's real, everything that's righteous, is the result of the work of your spirit at home in my heart. And if I did something that was worthy of praise, then I'm going to bring that praise right back to you because I know that you alone are worthy of praise in my life. You carry that praise bundle back to God. And we looked at that principle through the lens of the story of that night when Jesus called Peter to get out of the boat and walk on water. And I try to imagine those moments when, from Peter's perspective and the perspective of his buddies as they were sitting in the boat, who stayed behind in the boat and watched all of this go down. And I have to say this morning, if I had to choose this morning between scoring a touchdown in the Super Bowl or pitching a no-hitter in the World Series or walking on water where all of you could see it, I'd pick walking on water any day, because that's like a life skill. You know, you eventually get too old to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl, but I don't know if you're ever too old to walk on water. I mean, we use that phrase when somebody scores a touchdown in the Super Bowl. Sometimes we'll actually say it that way. That guy walked on water, for crying out loud. Did you see that miracle that unfolded? And now the Chiefs are going to... Well, anyway, I don't know how many of us can claim the kind of success that Peter experienced that night on the Sea of Galilee. He walked on water. And I can imagine his buddies sitting there in the boat when the moment came that they heard Peter say to Jesus, Lord, if that's you out there, then bid me come to you. Call me to come to you. I think they probably looked at Peter and said, dude, seriously? What are you? Listen to yourself. You realize what you're asking him for right now. Seriously? I think that they were shocked. But when he stepped out of the boat and stood on top of the water, they probably changed their tone. Dude, whoa, you know, we didn't know you had it in you. This is like way cool. Now I kind of wish that I wasn't sitting here in the boat and, you know, that I was out there instead of you. But then came that moment when he sank beneath the waves and, dude, you know, I mean, are you okay? You're just, this has turned out badly. It would have been a roller coaster for Peter's buddies there in the boat, but nothing like the roller coaster ride that Peter himself went on that night. Remember, Peter walked on water and experienced a success beyond any kind of success he had ever experienced before or ever dreamed, and then he sank and experienced unparalleled failure and fear. And then Jesus reached down and pulled Peter back up under the surface of the water. And at that moment, not drowning would have been a tremendous relief. So I was afraid and now I'm relieved, but I'm still a little embarrassed, or maybe a lot. And then Jesus had this conversation with Peter about his faith and asked why Peter had chosen to doubt, why he had chosen not to trust in those few minutes. And if I'm Peter, I'm pretty ashamed at that moment that Jesus had to have that conversation with me, because that's not how I had that gamed out. Walking on water was going to be the thing in my life up to that point, and now it's turned into this. And then Jesus turns Peter around and walks him back toward the boat, and it would have been nice to be back at the boat, but the boat is where all my buddies are at that point, and I think they're sitting there shaking their heads and saying, dude, you know, that was just... What were you thinking? They're back to that. Because that did not turn out the way we expected, and we're pretty sure it didn't turn out the way you expected either. So let's think about this for a moment. Peter cried out to Jesus. Those are the words that actually appear there in Matthew. Peter cried out to Jesus and pleaded to be saved from drowning after he's under the water. And this is what I want you to think about. When Jesus reached down his hand and grabbed Peter's hand, Peter could have pulled his hand away, I mean, instead of taking Jesus' hand, and said something like, Lord, that's not quite how I had this all gamed out. You know, I'm down here in the water, but when I said save me, I, I, I had something else in mind. When I asked you to save me, I kind of had in mind that you would just like do this magical levitate me thing, and I would rise to the surface of the water, and then you and I, you know, we could just kind of walk to shore together. That's kind of how I had this sorted out. I wanted to be able to do this on my own. So rather than me taking the hand that you're offering, how about we just try that? Because I think that will work better in the long run for me and you. And you just then you taking my hand and pulling me back up would work. Because Jesus, I mean, look back, you see all the guys in the boat? They're watching me right now, you know? I mean, they're evaluating me. They're thinking things about me right now. So I just kind of like to magical, levitate. How about it? And I know perhaps you're sitting there thinking, well, Peter never would have said anything like that, and maybe it's just me, but I need you to know that I might have said that. I might have said exactly that. I might have started bargaining with Jesus because I do that all the time. When I'm in a difficult situation, I ask God to meet my need. Lord, save me from this. And then I tell him how I expect him to do that. This is how this is going to play out, God. This is what I want to see. I even tell God that I want to see a miracle, and I don't want any of that character development stuff, God. No. I want a miracle, not any character development. I don't want you to fix me. I want you to fix my problem. That's what I'm after here. That's why I'm talking to you about this. So any plans you might have had of doing something, you know, in me, no, let's just go settle for doing something through me, and that's the way. I don't want you to fix me. I just want you to fix my problem so that I can get back to doing the stuff that you have asked me to do. So because of my own messed up heart, I don't want to put that on you, but because of my own messed up heart, I can picture Peter telling Jesus what to do and then telling him how to do it, how it should go down. Because Peter had something good going on when he was walking on top of the water. And the other guys had to be impressed with Peter at that moment, that he had pulled that off. But then he sank, and all the other guys must have been saying to themselves, so, he is just like the rest of us after all. He's just one of the guys. Nothing super about this fella at all. In other words, Peter would have gained credibility on top of the water, serious credibility, and he would have lost credibility as he sank beneath the waves. And let's be clear here. Peter walked on water, so his success meant something. But he also sank and cried out to be saved, and that meant something too. And I'm going to just go on record as saying this. In my book, Peter learned a far more valuable lesson through his sinking failure than he ever could have learned through his success at walking on water. Peter got back in that boat a richer man, not because he had walked on water, but because he had sunk beneath the waves and cried out to Jesus for help. And I'm just naive enough to believe that deeper lesson that came through failure was part of Jesus' plan all along. I believe that's why Jesus was so enthusiastic about having Peter come out of the boat to meet him. Jesus knew both things were going to happen, and I'll go so far as to say that Jesus engineered both so that Peter could learn the lesson that he had built into that moment. He invited him to join him outside of the boat because of what he was going to accomplish in Peter's life, not simply through. Think about the conversation that Jesus had with Peter after he sank. Jesus very simply said two things. He looked at him and he said, oh, Peter, your faith is so small. And then he asked the most poignant question, perhaps in all of the New Testament. Why did you doubt? And I have to say this morning that I don't think that was a rhetorical question. It was a real question. In other words, Jesus didn't ask the why did you doubt question as a means of introducing a sermon point. That's not what he was doing. Because if that's what that was, then he would have preached a sermon to Peter right out there on the water. They'd have had a really cool conversation. And Jesus, this was not Jesus introducing a sermon point. Without forcing Peter to answer that awful question, Jesus turns him around and they walk together back to the boat. And they get into the boat again, and as soon as they're in the boat, the wind and the waves stop. Jesus asked Peter why he had doubted, and then he didn't wait for an answer. because he expected Peter to ask that question of himself. It wasn't a rhetorical question. It was a real question. How did you get here, Peter? How did this moment overcome you? Why did you doubt? And let me say it again. I'm still young enough, even at my age, I'm still young enough and naive enough to believe that Jesus set the whole thing up and called Peter out of the boat so that Peter could have that experience that night of both walking on water and sinking beneath the waves. And I believe Jesus did all of that so he could ask this question of Peter. Why did you doubt? And I'll go one further with you. I know that a lot of us are worried about COVID. And I think that we need to be concerned enough about it to take every precaution. There's no question in my mind about that. But I don't think that there's any reason for us to live in fear. And even at those times when we feel our feet sinking beneath the COVID waves, and we've all felt that from time to time, COVID is formidable. There's no question about that. But it's no reason for us to begin to believe that God doesn't love us, for us to begin to doubt God's love. And it's no reason to doubt his care for us in our in our daily lives as our shepherd. So do everything that's necessary to keep from infecting other people and be courageous, not cavalier, courageous, as this thing continues to drag on. And in the meantime, back to Peter. The preceding commercial was brought to you by. Now, Jesus asked the question, and he didn't wait for an answer before he pulled Peter out of the water. And then suddenly, they're back in the safety of the boat, and the wind and waves have died down, and they're finally able to make their way back towards shore. And I have to say that I don't think Peter popped in his earbuds to listen to his tunes at the moment because he had won the game. You know, that wasn't what was going on. He wasn't sitting there thinking, I walked on water. That was so... It's not what Peter was thinking. That's what he might have thought. But that's not what Peter was thinking. He didn't pop in his earbuds to listen to his tunes as he sat in the boat and pondered his own awesomeness. That was not how Peter spent the rest of the way to the shoreline. I think he sat there in the boat quietly and pondered that question that Jesus had asked him. I think he personalized that question and repeated it to himself over and over. Why did I doubt? Why did I doubt? I think he turned that inside out and backwards and forwards in every way he could possibly imagine as he looked for an answer to that question. Why did I doubt? Given who Jesus is and given the moment that it was unfolding, why did I doubt? In fact, I think he asked himself that question so often in the days and weeks and months that lay ahead because he was looking for an answer to that question. But that still leaves us with a question. Is that it for Peter? Is he just this doubting, fearful dude that Jesus is going to have to put up with instead of actually using? I can't tell you that Peter found an answer to that why did I doubt question that night. But I can tell you that he did. And what an answer it was. And I want to tell you that story this morning about when it becomes clear that Peter had gotten over his doubts about Jesus and who Jesus was and what Jesus meant. I will tell you that story, but I don't want to get ahead of myself just yet. In the meantime, it's time to get back to Psalm 23. And once again, I want you to think of this passage of Scripture in terms of the story that lies behind it. David, the shepherd of Israel, was thinking one day about all that he had to do to take care of the sheep, all the tending, all the feeding, all the taking care of parasites and illnesses, and it was all on him. And in his mind's eye, I believe he began to picture all that God did, all the things that God did in a day to take care of him as God shepherded David. And he took up his lyre and some parchment, and he wrote a poem that eventually became a song. Or did he write a song that we now quote as a poem? I'm not sure. But I would invite you to picture the sheep in the pasture as you listen to the 23rd Psalm. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything that I need. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. We're on a roll with these stories about Peter, so I want to tell you another story about Peter this morning. It's a story about something that happened 1 year almost to the day. 1 year almost to the day after Jesus' crucifixion. And with that background, this is the story from God's Word from Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 19, if you want to fact check me. Herod was the king in Israel during this time, and he was a figurehead since the Roman Empire had long ago occupied the nation of Israel. But Herod did have some latitude in terms of the kind of power that he could exercise and the sort of things that he could do. One day, he gave orders to arrest some of the followers of Jesus, some of the apostles, and he had them put in jail to persecute them because of their choice to follow Jesus. And you may remember from reading the Gospels that John, one of the disciples of Jesus, whose book we studied a while back, a couple years ago, had also become an apostle, and he had a brother named James, who was also a disciple and an apostle. James and John were brothers, and while Jesus was still alive, the people around James and John referred to those two guys as the sons of thunder. And I'm not sure everything that that means, but I mean, these were get-in-your-face kind of dudes. They really were. Well, James was one of the people that Herod had arrested, and he kept James in prison. The others he released, but he kept James in prison for a while, and then Herod made the decision to execute James, to have James executed. And as the sentence was carried out, James became the first apostle to die. First, they're all going to die in martyrs' deaths, except for John, who will die on the Isle of Patmos of old age. He'll die in exile, but the death of James, of course, had a powerful effect, a terrible effect on the early church. But the people who were not Jesus followers thought that this was awesome. This was a great call on Herod's part. Herod became inflated by that, and that's when Herod decided to have Peter arrested during the festival of unleavened bread, which precedes the Passover. James has been executed during that stretch of time, precedes the Passover, and you'll remember that a year before at Passover was when Jesus was crucified. So a year has lapsed, during which Peter has seen Jesus crucified and James executed. He intended to put Peter on trial, Herod did, publicly after the Passover holidays that week, and four squads of four soldiers each guarded Peter in his cell in six-hour rounds, and Peter was being held in the prison, but the followers of Jesus were praying for him all the time. Peter must have suspected that things wouldn't end well for him, especially since Jesus had been executed and James lately had been executed so recently. And despite that, the night before he was to be tried, Peter was sound asleep while he was chained between two soldiers there in his cell, one on each side of them. And the other two soldiers in that squad were keeping watch at the door of the cell. That's how they rotated through the six hours. Suddenly, an angel of the Lord appeared there in the cell. Just right there in the cell. You know, think Star Trek if you need to. But he flooded the entire area there, the cell and everywhere around, with light. Peter was sound asleep at the time. So the angel walked over to Peter and had to actually hit him on the side and shout to him, "Wake up, Peter! Wake up! We got to get out of here! Quick, get up!" The angel says, and as soon as Peter got up, the chains fell off of his wrists, and then the angel then told him that to get dressed and to put on his sandals, and then said, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." Peter got dressed and followed him, but really had no idea that it was all really happening. It's a really kind of a cool part of the story. He actually thought he was seeing a vision or, I don't know, maybe dreaming or something. And so he follows the angel out the door, and Peter and the angel pass the first and second guards, and then they come to the iron gate that, as they're out of the prison, they come to the iron gate that leads into the city, and the gate just opened by itself as they approached it, and they went through it, and they walked along the length of one street, and the angel suddenly disappeared. Just as suddenly as he had appeared only moments before. And there's more to this story, so you should go and look at it. But time demands that I say that is the story from God's word. And I want you to notice in the story that the story begins with James being executed. And I wonder if we realize today how devastating that was for the early church and how unnerving it could have been for Peter and John and for the rest of the apostles. You probably know that Peter, James, and John were Jesus' closest friends, and they three formed the core of the leadership of the church in the book of Acts. And this story that I told you begins with the execution of James. So it seems right away that no one is safe. No one is going to be protected from, no one is exempt from the possibility of paying the highest of prices. And James is arrested, imprisoned, and executed right before Passover. And now Peter's in prison, and he had every reason to believe that once Passover is over, that he will be executed as well. He's at least going to go on trial, and likely that trial will end with execution. They didn't have a stay of execution. They when someone was convicted, they executed in that same day, that same moment as they left. And Peter had no way of knowing that that's exactly what Herod was planning. That is exactly what Herod was planning. So for all intents and purposes, he's a condemned man, and this is the last night of his life as he lay there in the prison. And that's probably why he spent the whole night in prison that night pacing his cell, wide awake, worried about the next day and what was going to go on, doubting whether God was actually in control of the situation or not. That's right, isn't it? He spent the whole night pacing in his cell. Is that how it went down in the story? No. The angel powers into his prison cell, this immense burst of light, and I don't know what kind of noise the angel made as he came in, but the chains, the bolt, the locks, that pow, everything's gone, and now the angel is standing there, and woo! Peter? Hey, Peter, wait, he has to go over and wake Peter up. Peter is sleeping so soundly that the angel has to pop him on the side to get him to, yeah. I don't think Peter was terribly worried that evening. Despite all the noise, all the light, the angel still has to hit Peter to wake him up. In fact, Peter has been sleeping so soundly that he's still groggy. He's so groggy as they're walking out that he thinks he's walking through a dream. I mean, he was out like a light. I don't think he... Had Xanax been invented back then? Some of you... I don't think so. He wasn't on Xanax. He was gone. He was dead to the world, sound asleep. He's not sure that the whole thing is really happening. And I want to remind you that this is the same guy who was so full of doubt that he slipped beneath the waves not too many months before. But that night in prison, there's no trace of that doubt left in Peter's heart. Jesus questioned Peter about doubt, Peter's doubt and fear that night on the water, and that's why Peter felt safe in the prison that night. That night, almost a year later. David put it this way in the 23rd Psalm. Even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. And from that, we draw the fourth principle of shepherding. Since God does that for us, the fourth principle is, if I'm a shepherd, it is because I comfort the sheep when they're afraid. I want to tell you about the longest night of my life. And I'm not saying that no night in my future will ever be might not be longer, but so far when I think about the longest night of my life, I have to reach all the way back to 1985 when our daughter Jennifer was 7 years old. David was 5. Bethany was almost 2. That was the year that I spent a long night standing between 2 hospital beds. Jennifer, our oldest daughter, was lying on one and David was lying on the other. And Jennifer, with whatever it was that she had suffering from, David was about a day behind her in the course of that. She was 7 years old, and she had fallen ill in the tribe. We were in the tribe, though we weren't entirely sure what was wrong. In the middle of the night there in the tribe, she began hallucinating. So we took her temperature, and believe it if you will or not, her temperature was so high that it didn't register on the thermometer. A thermometer only goes up to 106 degrees, and her temperature was above that. Faith shook it down and took her own temperature and registered normal, and so we knew that it was accurate, but we also knew that she was in real danger at that point. A few weeks before, I had had typhoid fever, and we wondered if that's what had laid her so low, but when her fever went that high, malaria made the most sense. Still, we didn't have the means there in the tribe to test for malaria or even to treat a case that severe if that, in fact, is what she had. And so we called the plane, and Faith and the kids flew out of the tribe and headed for a hospital in Manila while I hiked down from our home there in the mountains. We transported her to Manila, and all along the way, her condition worsened, and the doctor ordered a blood count on Jennifer when we first got there to the hospital, and when the results came back, her hemoglobin, which is normally 12.5 to 14 in that range, but Jennifer's hemoglobin was 8 when we arrived at the hospital, so it was considerably below normal. 2 hours later, they did the test again, and her blood count was 7.2, and an hour after that, it had dropped to 6. Something was destroying her blood. We didn't know what. I called a doctor friend of mine and told him what was happening, and I asked him how low her blood count could go before it became life-threatening, before it became truly dangerous, and he told me as quickly as her blood is being destroyed, anything below 5 could be fatal. An hour later, they tested again, and it was 5.2. It got into the place where when she sat up, she couldn't see, and when she tried to stand at all, she would just pass out. She was gone. Gotten to the place where I have to admit, I was afraid at that point. Bethany was just a baby at that time, and she was exhausted, so I stayed at the hospital that night with Jennifer and David as Faith took Bethany back to the guest house and tried to get some sleep, though I'm not sure how much Faith slept that night either. Shortly after they left, the nurse came in again to draw blood, and when the results came back, they told me that Jennifer's blood count was 3.6. Well below the danger zone. I stood between those two beds, and I prayed like I'd never prayed before. I'm not sure that I ever prayed before that night, as I begged with God for the life of my kids, asked God for a miracle in whatever it was that was going on. And at about midnight, I began to believe that God was gonna work and he was gonna move. And I don't know why I thought that, but I was reassured. And by 1 a.m., I had pulled a chair up like the one you're sitting in right now, in between the two beds. And I put my feet up on Jennifer's bed and tried to catch some sleep. And at 2 o'clock that morning, I woke with a pain in my back and wasn't sure if it was because of the position I was sitting in or what, but to make a long story short, that night I had a full-blown kidney stone attack and I didn't know there was pain like that. And so I called Faith on the phone and I asked her to come back from the guest house because I couldn't sit with the kids anymore. I couldn't sit between their beds and all of this when my daughter is near death and my son appeared to be just a day or so behind her. Faith came in and relieved me so that I could go down to the emergency room and get the medication that they were recommending. And when Faith arrived, I could see that she was in as much pain as I was. And I tried to help, but nothing came to mind other than, you know, if my doctrine would let me believe it, it just feels to me like God has abandoned us here in this place. And we agreed together that God hadn't abandoned us. We know that he didn't do things like that. We fell into one another's arms and cried. We met with a doctor after the sun came up, and he gave us some hope that he knew what to do. He wanted to give her 2 units of blood and treat for malaria, even though we couldn't get a malarial smear to come up positive. We weren't sure that she actually had malaria, but he believed that that would help. And we agreed, and he spent the next few minutes giving instructions to interns and doctors and nurses that were standing around us in that conference room as Jennifer was so near death, and then he leaned in after they were all gone and said to Faith and me, "Don't worry, we'll figure this out." That was what he said. Now, I knew from God's word that I wasn't supposed to worry, and the doctor had just told us not to worry, so I decided not to worry and settled instead for just being afraid of what God was going to do. And I don't mind telling you that I was afraid. I could easily imagine God being stern with me and working to teach me a lesson at a potentially the highest of prices, at a terribly high cost. Back then, I didn't truly understand who God is, and I thought that perhaps he might be in a mood to punish me for my youthful carelessness in life. And I knew that Jesus had already been punished for me. But that night, as that unfolded, that morning, as that went down, it didn't resonate with me. I didn't fully understand back then that he had taken all of my punishment. And I thought that God might punish me still by hurting my kids if he gets in a bad mood. I want to say very clearly that I know now that God doesn't work like that, but back then, I expected that he might even take one of my children to get my attention. I was doubting him, big time. I told you that story because after my kidney stone attack, as Jennifer was receiving the treatment, and before she had recovered, I returned in the late morning to the guest house to get a shower before going back to sit with Faith by Jennifer and David's beds. And at noontime that day, I thought I'll just run in real quick and get some lunch. I hadn't been eating. And remember, I'd hiked miles the day before and then had been up all night and had a kidney stone attack. I was in more than one kind of pain. And so I was totally worn out. I was overwhelmed. And I have to admit, despite my promise to trust God in everything, I was still fearful that we might lose both Jennifer and David. I was afraid, and because of that, I doubted God. We trust God, remember, not to keep bad things from happening, but to sustain us in the midst of the hardship. But at that moment, I felt like I had reason to doubt God because Jennifer had been so near death, and David had had the same thing that she had and was only a day or so behind her, and we didn't know how that was going to turn out, and so my doubt gave birth to fear. And in the midst of that crushing weight and the fear of the situation, I had decided to take a few minutes and have lunch down at the dining room of the guest house. And that's when someone who was trying to help said, "Have you figured out what the Lord is trying to teach you through all this that you're facing right now?" I know he meant well, but I felt like he was using my heart for target practice. He cut me to the heart. He was poking and prodding in the middle of my pain, and he was adding to my fear. This was the thing I was concerned about. This was the thing that I was afraid of, and that's the thing that he went after, sitting there in that dining room. I was still in pain physically, and my emotional pain went even deeper, so his question was like a kidney punch to me. It was an important question, but it was ill-timed. And so I resented the intrusion. And I think that it would have been better if he had waited until after the crisis to ask me that question. Because he didn't take the time to make himself aware of my needs, but he did take the time to guess at my needs and how I was feeling. And then he attempted to meet those needs that he assumed I had. And in that process, he did nothing to ease the pain. He did nothing to ease the fear that I was carrying that day. Still, I have to admit that as a young man, I looked ahead to, and feared what God would do. And now as an old man, listen to me, I can look back and tell you without any hesitation that Faith and I have never walked alone. Never. In the course of our lifetime, in the course of serving him, in the course of the fear, in the course of the heartache, we have never walked alone. Difficult and even tragic things happen and will continue to happen. But I can tell you that God has been in complete control in every situation we have ever faced. And if I had it to do over, I'd continue to look back and see God's goodness in retrospect. But then I would apply that looking back knowledge and see God in real time today and believe, trust that he was going to keep his promises just like he always has. I'd look ahead with that confidence. I would have spent less time worrying and more time trusting so that I could say that I know he always leads me along right paths. That's been our experience. And even when that path passes through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear because you are with me. That's the way David phrases it. He's my shepherd. And if you're a follower of Jesus, then he's your shepherd too. And that means that we don't have to be fearful of what he's going to do. We just have to remember that he always does what's best. You see, I can't offer hope to other people when I'm choosing to live without hope myself. That's not how it works. And in the spirit of picking up where I left off, I can tell you that the treatment worked. Many of you know Jennifer, and you can attest that she has survived, and In fact, 8 hours after they started the treatment and administered the 2 units of blood, she was sitting up in her hospital bed and eating supper. And I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I was afraid for Jennifer and David. Needlessly afraid for Jennifer and David. I was afraid that God was vindictive and that his love, I was afraid that his love was no better than mine. I was afraid as I sat there at lunch that day. And for some reason, my friend was more focused on the lesson that I needed to learn than he was on comforting me in the midst of my pain, in the midst of my fear. Instead, he confronted me. If you can see now how he should have comforted me instead of confronting me, then we're ready to move on to the next principle of shepherding. David says, Psalm 23 says, even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And I want to remind you here that David knew that his shepherd would be there for him, no matter how frightening things became. David knew that his shepherd would always be there for him, no matter how dark, no matter what circumstances overshadowed him. And as I mentioned earlier from that, we draw principle 4. If I'm a shepherd, it's because I comfort the sheep when they're afraid, just as God comforts me when I'm afraid. Again, I don't pretend to understand livestock, but I know that sometimes sheep are frightened. And I admit that when we bring that over into the church world, it doesn't sound very spiritual, does it? It doesn't sound very mature of us. But when I was little, just, 5 years old or so, we lived at 10 Bailey Road in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. It was a nice house, but there was one thing that caused me no end of grief in that house. The basement, the switch for the basement light was a pull chain at the bottom of the basement stairs. Now, that may not mean much to you, but that was outrageous for a 5-year-old. Because that's the worst place you can put the switch for a basement light, right there at the stinking bottom of the stairs. Having the switch down there meant that you had to walk all the way to the very bottom of the stairs before you could turn on the light. Walk down into the darkness so that you could feel around for that light chain to pull it. But that was at least doable because you could face the darkness. You could look into the darkness as you felt around for the chain. And I would turn the light on as a child and do or get whatever my mom had sent me down there to do or get. And it was always my mom, like she didn't care about my life at all. And the problem was that you had to turn around and point your back at the darkness as you turn the light switch off and then made it up the stairs. That meant turning your back to the darkness. And that basement, it was chock full of monsters and dinosaurs in every crevice, and they always hid when the light was on and my parents were down there. I knew better. I knew they were there. I just knew they were there. And so, I would stand there and just kind of hold my breath as I pulled that switch and then head up the stairs, which I typically did in a single bound. Superman had nothing on me back in those days. And I know all of you adults are going to say that there were no monsters or dinosaurs down in that basement. And I believe you now. But there's no way you could have convinced me as a kid. I'm not falling for that. All adults say that. And I know it's not true. And that's because, hear me, that's because my fears were real, even if the things that I feared were not. My fears were real, even if the things that I feared were not. All that to say that we do nothing for the sheep when we dismiss their fear. And it doesn't matter how many times you say, oh, come on, you don't have to be afraid of that. Matthew 10, 29 and 31 says, are not 2 sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will, not the knowledge, the will of your Father. Not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Do you know in part what those verses mean? Those mean that Jesus recognized that fear is a real part of being human. A real part. He didn't dismiss our fears. He simply reminded us who we are. We are children of the living King. We are sons and daughters of Almighty God. But what does that really mean? Does it mean that we'll never be in danger? It doesn't mean that at all, does it? It doesn't mean that at all. He could do that, But he never chooses to do that. During part of our time when we were living among the Bukalot again, and we lived in a village called Lipuga, and many of you have been there in Lipuga, so you would recognize where it is, what I'm talking about. But it was a two-day walk from the lowlands back then, or a 25-minute ride in the mission plane. And so we often, as much as we were able, chose to take the mission plane. We flew. And there came a time when I needed to be in Manila for meetings, and so we arranged for the plane to come in and pick up our family, and the plane arrived right on schedule. It was a Helio Courier, very like that one right there, and Martin Burnham actually flew the plane in. He was our pilot during that time. That's Gracia Burnham's husband, and he landed, did a perfect landing on that 700-foot-long airstrip, and then spun the plane around. And as he spun the plane around, there's a huge gust of wind that nearly picked up the tail from behind. Right after he got the plane spun around, it blew the wrong way down the airstrip. For the most part, the air was calm, but there were these gusts, and they were unpredictable, and they were all coming from the back of the plane, hitting the plane in the back, which meant that we would have no lift as we made our way down the airstrip. You can take off into a pretty good wind, a good headwind, but a tailwind, and it was a one-way strip, so there really weren't options. Sat in the plane all that day as one gust after another blew through, and we finally just had to call it quits and go back to the house and spend the night there. And the next morning, we're back at the airstrip at first light, and the battery had run down for the plane, and so Martin got in and did the things that he needed to do and then asked me to prop it, you know, that thing that they do with the, and then you get out of the way. I learned that lesson. And then the engine started when we propped the plane, and we waited for the gusts to stop, but they wouldn't. And in fact, they were a little bit more consistent, you know, today, more determined than they'd been the day before. And that's when Martin remarked that the wind wasn't constant. It was just coming in gusts. And usually there was an interval between the gusts. And so he got the idea, and I guess I encouraged him in it, but he got the idea that maybe right after the next gust goes through, you know, we'll just kick it and go, and then we'll be airborne by the time, you know, the following gust hits. And so that's what he did. We waited for the gust, and, you know, it shook the plane, and then he pushed the throttle, and we got about halfway down the strip past the point of no return and got hit from behind with another gust. And so we stayed on the ground instead of going up, and at the end of the airstrip, there was kind of a drop-off that made it possible to, you know, for you to gain altitude before you flew over the trees. And well, with the gust hitting us from behind like that, we didn't get any lift. We kind of fell off the end of the airstrip, and now we're headed down this way, and Martin is spinning, you know, and dodging, literally dodging trees. He's going in between in the little space that was there, and he's still trying to gain altitude. And then finally we got up above the trees, and that's when the wind got even more ferocious. So now we're, you know, we've at least gotten above the trees, and looks like we're going to be okay. And Martin called Gracia and said, we're airborne for Arizao. And Gracia came back on the radio and said, can't do that. It's raining really hard here. There's nowhere to land. And so we thought of another tribal strip that we knew would be open and maintained, and Martin decided to go there. And it was down a valley that was perpendicular to the valley that we were on at the time. And when we turned into that valley, that was when the wind just let loose. We were getting gusts that were just kind of boiling down over, but out there in that valley, it was horrendous. And I don't know if you've ever ridden in a small plane, but think piece of paper, because that's pretty much what it felt like. We were being blown around, and, you know, there's trees over here, steep valleys, and we're side-slipping over there, and then side-slipping over here, and it really looked like one of those side-slips was just going to take us into the trees with family and all. No chance that we could land. And so I looked over my shoulder. Faith was back there with Jennifer and David. And Bethany was strapped in, her seatbelt was strapped into my seatbelt, sitting on my lap there in the front of that Helio Courier. I looked back at Jennifer and David and Faith, and they were clearly terrified. And so I decided to check on Bethany, and I had a headset on that I was talking to Martin, and, you know, we were able to talk to Gracia as well. As Bethany was sitting there on my lap, I thought I should check on her. So I lifted my headset, and I looked down at my little girl. And she was crying. I mean, she was just breaking her heart. She was so terrified, despite the fact that she was sitting on her daddy's lap. And that's when my daddy heart took over. And over the din of the engine and the wind, I shouted. We didn't typically shout at our kids unless it was necessary like that. But I shouted to her. I said, "Bethany, you can be brave. You can be brave because Jesus and Uncle Martin really know how to fly an airplane. Be brave, sweetheart." I offered her some encouragement that I was not feeling. I wasn't entirely convinced myself. And I watched her wipe the tears away and she actually stopped crying. And it was clear that she had borrowed from my strength. She had borrowed from my courage. But that may leave you wondering where my courage had come from. I'll tell you where it came from. I was watching Martin. And Martin clearly was concerned, but he was not afraid. He was not overwhelmed with fear. And that's where my strength came from. I borrowed it from Martin. We're still being blown all over the place, and the next airstrip was still miles away. But as I flew, I became aware of a little noise somewhere in the plane. I wasn't sure where it was coming from. And when I leaned over, it was coming from Bethany. It looked like she was saying something. I couldn't figure out what she was saying. I thought maybe she was talking to me. And so I slipped off my headphones again, and I leaned in to hear her, and she was singing. Si no hay namayan ma banka. Si no hay namayan ma banka. Si no hay namayan ma banka. Intorno son ma dito. She was singing a song in Bukalot about how God took care of Noah and his family in the ark during the flood. She was singing. Her heart had revived. And now suddenly it had come full circle. Because the courage that my little girl was showing in trusting God in that moment came back to me. I had loaned it to her for a little while, and it came back to me. She was strengthening me in my resolve to trust Christ no matter what was happening. And that makes me want to ask you this question this morning. 2 more minutes to go. When you're in a dangerous and frightening situation, is there enough of a supply of confidence in God in your heart to make it possible for other people to borrow from you? I heard a story a while back about a daddy whose little girl was called out to him at 3:00 in the morning, the middle of the night, to say that she was afraid of the dark. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands how many of us may have done that when we were little or had that experience when we were younger. But he didn't really want to get out of bed at 3:00 in the morning and go talk to her. And so he did the next best thing. He called out to her through the darkness. "Jesus is there with you," he said, "so you don't need to be afraid." And her tiny voice called back, "I know that Jesus is here with me, but right now I need someone with skin on." Sometimes the sheep just need someone with skin on. Someone who can physically represent Jesus to them. Physically represent Christ to them. And that need's not limited to little ones. We all face it from time to time. Trust me. We all face it from time to time, no matter how big or grown up we think we are. So pull yourself out of bed and find your way through the dark to that frightened little lamb and lend your courage to him or her, even during those times when you feel like you don't have enough courage to go around. And think about this. You never know when you may need to borrow courage from someone else. So don't be stingy with what you share with others. There's an old song that says, "Brother, let me be your servant. Let me be as Christ to you. Pray that I might have the grace to let you be my servant too. I will hold the Christ light for you in the nighttime of your fear. I will hold my hand out to you and speak the peace you long to hear." Principle number 4. If I am a shepherd, it's because I comfort the sheep when they're afraid. And by way of reality checks, do you have a sense that you are worth more than many sparrows, as Jesus put it? Or do you secretly worry that God might have reasons to not take care of you? Keep in mind that you can't offer something to someone else that you don't possess. You can't offer them courage if you personally are full of fear. And the second reality check, do you dismiss the fears of God's people? Do you choose to rebuke them? Or do you use the opportunity to point them to the presence of God, to point them back to the shepherd of their souls? After all, like we talked about last week, you want to keep the sheep that are under your care walking along the right path. And the right path, listen to me, is always defined by trusting God rather than fearing the situation. Will you stand with me in the presence? Father and our God, we thank you today for your goodness. Thank you for the humor in the way you remind us of events that passed, events that weren't funny at the time, until we look back and see your hand and see where you showed up and we see your face. God, thank you for the way you shepherd us, the way you meet our needs, the way you reach into our lives, the way you dispel our fear, the way you are courageous on our behalf when we can't find the courage to respond the way we need to. Thank you for the privilege we have of passing that along. Because the Lord is my shepherd, I have everything that I need. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And even though I walk through the dark valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil because you are with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and your love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen and amen. The assignment is to go out there and care about somebody. If it's your own kids, then do that. If it's your spouse, then do that. If it's a stranger along the road, then do that. But go out there and care about somebody. We've huddled up and decided on the play. Now all that's left is for me to say, ready? Go get them, Potter's House.